There are many things that can be said about Russia today and its leader, Vladimir Putin. The main question for Americans being, how prominent a part should Russia play in America's foreign policy? With me is David MacDonald, professor of history at the UW-Madison. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Oh, good to be back, Norman. Very nice to be here.
Let's revisit first, before we get into Russia today, how it all fell apart for the Soviet Union.
It fell apart. If I were giving the long answer, I would start in World War II, the moment of its greatest accomplishment. But in real terms, it started falling apart in the Brezhnev period. You got a lot of ossification in the senior ranks of the Communist Party that often suppressed any type of initiative or creativity on the part of regional leaders. So you had tensions within the party. You also had a sudden economic crisis with the collapse of oil prices in the 1980s. And just as your quote suggested, the Soviet Union had long been dependent on the hard currency revenues it earned from oil exports. But also at a time when the Silicon Revolution was really taking picking up speed in the 1980s, which had all sorts of implications for military technology and for computing technology. So there's a sense of a growing gap between the Soviet Union's capacity for projection of power, which was also being more physically demonstrated in Afghanistan with a very familiar-looking wasting conflict that cost them more blood and treasure than they could really afford, and was also a very palpable propaganda hit to the political order. You had symbolic crises like Chernobyl.
Yes.
Which the new Secretary General Mikhail Gorbachev, in many ways, exploited to push down the throats of a reluctant Central Committee the necessity of greater openness. We'll remember the term glasnost, and also the necessity to ramp down tensions with the United States to be able to concentrate on domestic reconstruction. There was still dedication to building what they would have called socialism, but it was meant to, in a funny way, it was a revival of the types of policies you'd seen under Nikita Khrushchev, was meant to try and re-engage a population that was visibly disaffected in some kind of project that they could call the building of socialism. And you also had a population that was profoundly disaffected, which was living a lot of its existence. I think by the late 1980s, if I remember the Economist magazine correctly, there was a quarter of household income that economists couldn't trace the source of. And, of course, it was from the black market, it was from gray market, it was from what they call living on the left-hand side. And finally, there is growing in this atmosphere of greater toleration for public dispute. We get two levels of growing fracture. One is these national forums, these popular assemblies that Gorbachev convenes to act as airing houses for national concerns and grievances, but also become a site in which recriminations are leveled at everybody else. But in tandem with that, the growing nationalities issues and of the
various republics,
of the various Soviet republics, in which the secretaries of those given national republics found themselves with split loyalties, because in real ways they depend on their domestic constituencies, including their party comrades, who had very localist priorities as opposed to the more federal perspective of Moscow. And then on top of that, 30 years ago, right about now, we see this attempt by the hardliners, the old hardliners of the generation before Gorbachev, trying to take back certain authority, but now being thwarted by a new body, the Russian Federation, which in June of 1991 had elected a president, a Boris Yeltsin, who'd been sent to Coventry, who'd been disgraced 6 months earlier. And now he was speaking for something that a great many Russians I knew in the 1970s when I first studied there and since then saw themselves as Russians rather than Soviets. And so this coup shows, A, the technological incapacity of the coup plotters, because the way word got out was faxes and the emails and things like this that they hadn't taken into account in controlling communications. The media were defiant of them, and the army would not come out to support them. And so this thing that we thought was this great Leviathan, sort of the Thanos of the old world order, turns out to be this Colossus with feet of clay, which to a lot of us, that was already evident in the 70s and 80s. But the way people started thinking about power and about the state and about the and just about their disaffection with the order, they were Russian patriots, the ones in Russia. Of course, Ukraine very quickly jumped ship.
Yes.
The Baltics had already done that by that summer. The Caucasus were not long to follow. And the Central Asian states eventually followed the same course. Russians wanted, well, it's not clear what they wanted. They wanted the old buggers out, and they wanted the old system and the old bosses, and they had a word for, there was a term for the party elites called the bosses. There was a very strong sense that this was a kleptocracy, that they were feathering their own nests and grinding people. But one observer, I think, noted quite correctly that it was about sort of respecting the dignity of Russian citizens, which they felt was being held in contempt. So it falls apart in a way. But I remember when we were there, it was, what was it, the poem Bliss It Was to Be?
Then, yes, to be young, very heaven.
Yeah. About the French Revolution. Well, we all felt, well, good, now they'll be like us. And so then
That's
the story
right.
becomes interesting both ways because Russians of various walks of life were very divided. Again, not unlike France, although less violent, not unlike France in the 1790s. On the other hand, we become participants in the process because we get the Pygmalion complex and think that Russia is going. We can make Russia look like us, and in so doing, we inadvertently prop up older institutions, older networks, and new ones. And so you get this period of the 90s that is just sheer chaos, and is remembered as such, despite our thinking, well, this is a failure of democracy. And out of this, there are certain bodies that survive. The armed forces barely hold it together. The nuclear arsenal, they managed to pacify the Ukrainian and the Kazakhstani deposits. But there's the agreements with the Reagan and the Clinton administrations and the first Bush administration. There's also, so the armed forces are fine. The church reemerges, probably the least told story in the wake of the collapse.
They're certainly visible,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, and finally, as we know now, security agencies, there's a lot of disbanding. There's a lot of what we call layoffs. And I mean, if you want things, if you're looking for Russia muscle in the Russian underworld, which had always been there, we just learned it because it was more evident in the 1990s. But the mafiosi and different oligarchs abroad and at home. But there was still hardcore. There was the skeleton of a security apparatus with quite a broad sense of its own writ. And then we get the revolving door prime ministerships of Yeltsin's second term. What do we see on New Year's Eve 1999 is this young man from Leningrad, now Petersburg, as of 1990, as I recall, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin, giving a speech which is called Russia on the Verge of a New Millennium, and laying out this very ambitious and heartening platform that Russia's got to be a rule of law state. We've got to get past the corruption. But we also have to remember that in Russian history, the state has a very specific role, and it is to oversee justice and provide material support. And he really gives a very humanizing picture of what the most reform-minded Tsarist politicians or Soviet politicians would have seen themselves doing. So, and then after that, it changes.
He's talking about a Russian state, though, not a Soviet state.
That's right. Yeah, the Soviet flag had come down on Christmas night 1991. And so, he thinks of it as a Russian state.
And he doesn't have ambitions to reconstitute a Soviet Union in some form?
He's been... He's interesting, especially I'm a historian chiefly of the imperial period, but it's interesting to see how he plays with the national history, because on the one hand, he'll hark back to people that would have been anathema to an old South Soviet leader. They wouldn't have referred to them with the same terms of warmth and respect that Putin does. At the same time, and he's often derisory of the Bolsheviks. He sees them as sort of inefficient and ham-fisted and all the rest of it. However, you cannot be a Russian or Soviet leader without wrapping yourself in the St. George's Cross with the Veterans Medal for those who served in World War II.
Probably the most sacred part of the Russian culture.
Yeah, if you wanted, outside of the War of 1812, their War of 1812, Napoleonic invasion, this was the one moment of true national mobilization. And it came at huge material and human cost. It took the Soviet Union years to recover, but this could be party leaders finally rediscover it, among the population, this could be seen as a real achievement of a Russian people,
and to defend the motherland.
Defend the motherland, yeah, and actually, in a lot of popular narratives, to step in where the state wasn't doing what it was supposed to,
How much of a role did the passing of the World War II generation play in what seemed so long and justifiably to be this Russian anxiety to have buffer states to insulate the Russian core from Western Europe and two world wars that were devastating? How much did the passing of that generation play in this kind of rethinking and willing to let go of the Soviet Union?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not so sure it was the passing of that generation, because they were the ones who objected to Gorbachev with the new thinking and foreign policy. They let the buffer states go because they couldn't rule them anymore. It was way too expensive, and they just were unwilling to spend the resources to support them. I think it's what we'd call Labor Day weekend of 1988. Gorbachev has a summit of all the then Warsaw Pact leaders, and says that basically, you're on your own. If you can't keep control, we're not going to come in and rescue you. And this was already, remember, Poland had reached this hybrid agreement where General Jaruzelski had come to a very grudging compromise with Lech Wałęsa and the Solidarność movement, and already something like parliamentary something or other was evolving in Poland. That's its own story and equally interesting right now. But I think economically and politically and strategically, it was just too much of a burden. And there were real opportunities to forge a new understanding with the United States on a level of parity. And, of course, China wasn't a player yet to the same extent it is now. I think Gorbachev saw this as a cultural and an economic and a strategic opportunity, and it just made sense in a whole number of ways.
So no more Hungary intervention 1956, no more Czechoslovakia intervention 1968.
Yeah.
Just let those former buffer states go their way as they will. What about NATO, though? I mean, they start joining NATO. Doesn't that get a little prickly?
Well, that's and depends who you talk to. There, like the big moment, and that's reunification of Germany, and
which is really happening at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's part of the same process. And remember, it's the fall of '89, where Hungary, there are first these rallies in Leipzig at this church in Leipzig on Monday nights. I know that because they'd report on them halftime in the football games. But you got these motorcades. Hungary opened its borders, and you got these motorcades of East Germans going through Hungary and then going into Austria. And it became more and more evident, more visible, and the ruling Communist Party, they got a new leader who, Egon Krenz, who was leader of the left party killed quite recently, but he tries to rule humanely, and of course you get the wall coming down that November. Same thing in Prague with the Velvet Revolution, Hungary, and then of course the bloody reckoning in Romania that Christmas time with the televised trial and
Ceausescu
and his wife,
who were executed.
Yeah, yeah.
then what is the goal of Gorbachev at this point?
I think Gorbachev really believed my own personal view of this is that Putin seems to be got himself caught in a similar cleft stick is in order to make the type of change that Gorbachev envisioned for Russia, he still had to contend. Well, he still believed in the governing authority of the Communist Party as the one that was institutionally and historically situated to perform this guiding role of the state, something Putin still subscribes to as well. But he was opposed by most of the elements, especially the older elements in his own party. So on the one hand, he had to try to find ways to outmaneuver them. So say with Chernobyl, he uses glasnost to call out the secretary of the district in which the communist leader of the district in which Chernobyl is located. And he became the poster boy concealments of the Communist Party and for corruption and for cravenness. And Gorbachev tried to make that as a symbolic representation of part of the old order.
Throw him under the bus.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so, but it was a way of outflanking hardliners in a central committee. The other thing he did, which was the real Faustian bargain, was to make a similar bargain with the provincial party secretaries in all the republics. And of course, that means they're now becoming even more brokers between Moscow and the local populations. But it basically, I would think, if you ask Gorbachev what he thought he was doing at the time, he would have said, "Well, I've somehow got to get a power vertical that will allow me to outflank the old, they called them buffaloes, the old buffaloes, and we can get together and develop a new relationship with society, and together we can build a new humane socialist state." But of course, time doesn't put up with that. There was a moment in the spring and summer of 91 where he could have made an alliance with a group of leading liberal and parliamentarist politicians. But given the choice between allying with them and allying with the party, he allied with the party because he believed that was still the directing center. And, of course, the people he allied with were the people who put him under house arrest in the Crimea in August of 91. Lenin was always big on Vladimir, not John. Was big on this tension between strategy and tactics, and always having to keep your eye on sort of long term goals. And of course, when you're in a maelstrom of events like this, even if they aren't violent, and there was little violence, but in Tbilisi and Vilnius and Kaunas, but it wasn't 1917. So when you're in the midst of these events, it's hard not to become responsive to your immediate demands. And I think, and you get buttons pushed. And Gorbachev's button was about how are you going to constitute authority? And he believed in the type of Communist Party he thought he was joining.
Before we get into Russia per se, do you have a sense regarding Chernobyl that it was kind of a wake-up call as to the futility of any kind of nuclear strike?
I'm not sure about that. I think what it did show was that there were elements to atomic energy and nuclear power that were inescapably international, right? My wife and I was over doing dissertation research that spring, and we just were returning to Vienna from Budapest, from Hungary, where we'd spent an incredibly economically efficient weekend because all the socialist states needed hard currency, so you got great deals. But we got back to Vienna and turned on BBC World Service, and they were just starting to get the news about Chernobyl. And we were 400, 500 miles away when it was happening. And sheep in Wales and in Sweden were irradiated and that.
Reindeer in Lapland Sami land.
Yeah, precisely. And so I think what that did was change thinking about potential consequences of meltdowns in a way that Three Mile Island didn't really, because it was so contained. But I think it was more a symbol of just how broken down Soviet technology was, too.
Well, having gotten that far, let's look at Russia as it is today, without the rest of the Soviet apparatus, and we'll do that shortly. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with David MacDonald, and we're talking about Russia today, having looked back at the Soviet Union and the causes that made it fall apart over the course of some years. Now we have this still substantial in territory, core state of Russia, with a presumably much more central authority now, ethnically not 100% Russian by any means, but still much more so than it would have been in the Soviet Union. And how is that going to hold together? And is this the point at which Putin really becomes a player?
I don't see the current Russia as being in danger of the types of territorial disaggregation that we saw with the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think economically it's tightly bound. I think in the neighboring republics, the institutions for sort of ethnic attribution or ethnic identification are strong enough that that they're happy with, you know, they're all fine except for Nagorno-Karabakh. They're more or less willing to live with the accommodations they have. And I don't see any Russian population wanting to become – there is every once in a while, actually more than every once in a while, there is a certain level of autonomism on the part of Siberia. And Siberians can often seem they see themselves as very distinct from back west, I don't think there's a danger of that type of disaggregation. I think one piece of evidence I'd use is I'm not sure how centralized the Russian state is right now. That you get. Or how much control they're seeking, or what kinds of control they're seeking. It's very much, now that the lie is being given to the type of rule that the Soviet Union embodied and the Communist Party, what's interesting is that, and to get at your question in a different way, where there's an element of really interesting uncertainty is what happens after Putin. Right.
Yes, I mean he's 66.
Yep, no, 60, he's 67. He was in Leningrad State University at the same time I was studying there. Didn't know him, but yeah, he's a couple of years older than me. But it might not happen today or tomorrow, but it's going to happen unless he's made a deal with somebody I don't know. What's the trouble is, and I was just looking at, there's a very good polling institute in Russia called Levada, L-E-V-A-D-A, and it has service in English. And they give you polls, and he's still doing 60-65% favor in the polls. But the party, the ruling party, and his prime minister, union parties, Unified Russia, Единая Россия, and then Dmitry Medvedev, the old four-year president as a prime minister, they're in the low 40s. And so what happens, how are you going to arrange any sort of orderly succession when the institution, when the organization is supposed to yield the successor, is in such a ill regard? Partly, it's one of the rhetorical tools Putin uses, is he will displace any blame on him by saying, well, I want what's good for you, but it's that state. But some politician referred to it as a swamp, I believe.
yes, I believe I've heard that term.
Same rhetoric. And actually, that politician got it from places like Russia and Turkey and that. So,
well, let's trace Putin a little bit. His early years, he has a reputation of having been something of a street fighter.
Yes. The guy I knew in Petersburg was a neighbor, was in the neighborhood, and he was a bit of a hood, and but he cleaned up his act and went to, as I said, Leningrad State University, got a law degree, and went to KGB, and was serving, I believe, in Dresden or Leipzig, one of the provincial centers, and so He had some authority, but I don't think he was the grand, you know, the John le Carré character. He was just he was a good soldier doing his job. And but he becomes, when he comes back to Leningrad, he becomes a protege of a guy named Anatoly Sobchak, who I believe had been one of his profs in law school. And Sobchak was very pro-reform, very liberal. Was mayor of Leningrad, but in the 90s, after it's become Petersburg again, Putin was involved with managing foreign economic relations. And so he would have gotten introduced to a lot of the foreign actors, but also to domestic, to emerging oligarchs. And
would have had experience then as an economist?
No. It was more, I think, just probably a trusted figure for Sobchak and Sobchak's successors, but also with an eye to the main chance, obviously. And I'm not immersed enough in the KGB and its aftermath to pass judgment on whether or not this was a plan all along, as some people have argued. But I don't think there's any way to plan that in the 1990s. The 1990s were just wild. But he rise to the position of some seniority and is back in the Federal Security Service and comes to Yeltsin's attention. And then Yeltsin would pluck people out of nowhere to become prime minister. And Putin was the latest one. And he was the guy there when Yeltsin decided he was going to retire. And so, but at the outset, Putin, he talked a good game. He's from our point of view, and was interested in, he was one of the first people to send sympathy after 9/11, but also raised the point that we often tend to lose sight from, is that post-Soviet Russia had been subject to a set of terrorist bombings.
Quite a few,
Moscow,
yes.
Moscow, Leningrad, other, Petersburg, other big urban centers, and there, and that ongoing war in Chechnya, and a lot of it was being subsidized by the same forces that were subsidizing the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. And so we've been dealing with this struggle for a long time, and welcome having you on board. And then it all starts to change, 2005 to 2007, 2008, where he starts to become more and more confrontational and more aggrieved in his relations with the West. And at the same time as the Russian economy is growing like Topsy, as if you were an oil economy, those were the days. And he strengthens the domestic economy, and consumerism becomes a big thing to a society that had long relied on the black market for whatever Jimcrack consumer goods they could get, and he brought order to the place, and he started representing Russia as a serious player.
Well, order was one thing that I guess some of the people who are familiar with the communist days kind of longed for better or worse, order.
Order, certainly, and that's a that's a watchword of any Russian statesman going back to the 19th century for the way they talk about dissent, is that order is disturbing social peace, et cetera, et cetera. But order and greatness.
The theme of many a country.
Yes. And I think I often give outreach talks where I say, you know, we always think of Russia as catching on to things late and all the rest of it. But in this make X great again, in the current iteration, Russia is the one that Russia and arguably China in the 90s are both the societies that really make this a centerpiece. And for Russians, if I'd been a regular factory worker in 1985, I would have had an apartment in wherever I was living, power, TV, my kids would go to a school, state-sponsored school, where they got usually good education. I'd get medical care, probably not as good as elsewhere in the world, but better than a lot of the world, and free. I had money in the savings bank, and I knew I was going to be able to take the odd trip to the Crimea for a holiday or to a sanatorium.
Predictability.
Yeah, predictability, and the sense that, you know, there are all sorts of things I don't like about the system, but it's the one we got, and I can make my life within it. And then I could turn on TV, or if I were more inclined, open journals or newspapers, and I'd see, if I'm a sports fan, Soviet athletes are dominating a lot of the world competitions. Soviet artists, even immigrants like Mstislav Rostropovich and the like, they're representatives of Russia's cultural achievements, and they take us seriously. We've got the nuclear deterrent. We've got great technology. We put people in space, and you could take certain pride in your country and know that your country, that whatever you thought about state socialism, it had succeeded in making Russia the co-superpower. Then come the 1990s, inflation, all the property relations are dissolved, good physicians are going abroad or going elsewhere, schools fall apart, bribery becomes a thing, the privatization of the economy takes place on basically piratic footing. And now, there had always been crime. There had always been violent crime. There had always been, you know, just like any modern society. But you didn't read about it. Now you're reading about it nightly because the press has become very yellow.
It's become yellow.
Yeah.
Isn't there enough crime to report on anyway?
Well, there is, but in the old days, it didn't. You didn't. So they just you suppressed it. And so they're reading. They're getting this image. Then you read about the oligarchs and the so-called new Russians by the late 90s.
Developing, in effect, a class structure then.
Oh, not that there always wasn't. But what's interesting now is the old Communist Party was quite demure almost in issuing any sort of a conspicuous display of wealth, whereas these people flaunted it. It was maybe this is where the Kardashians got the idea from, but I doubt it. But there was just this sense. And on top of that, if I'm a sports fan again, I look at TV, my teams are all pathetic and losing, and people are dissing us. And the United States, people like that columnist, are writing the same thing. There's a very good historian who said the Russian moment is over, that they've been really powerful for 1,000 years and it's over. And whatever your underlying political sympathies were, any Russian, just like any patriotic citizen in any country, took great pride in the richness and the scale and the achievement in their history, and they were being told they were throwaways. And so for them, there's a whole generation that felt it was left behind by history, not only left behind, but swindled by history. And this is a really powerful constituency for Putin, and one to whom he appeals more and more as the 21st century moves on.
Well, rumor has it that Putin, unlike, I'd venture to say, any of his predecessors in Russian or Soviet leadership, maybe even in Tsarist Russia, is reputed to be worth somewhere between $40 and $200 billion personally.
Yeah, I heard that. And it could be, yeah. That, I'm not sure. The name that's going to come up anyway, but Navalny, right? Alexei Navalny, his YouTube channel broadcast this 2-hour documentary on this pleasure dome he's built
right
down, that is just it makes Xanadu look like a piker, and or Kublai Khan look like a piker, and it's hard to say. People say, well, that's just what guys like that do. I mean, talking about Russians, it's hard to get moral dudgeon about it, but they find it easy to do about oligarchs and the like, because part of it is you've never had, and it's just, and it's worked in that society, and that, but the idea of accountability is never really been well established, because the population has never really felt a stake in getting involved in politics. And it's always been a special zone. And it's always been a game for certain players in a different way than here. And certainly in a different way than most of Europe and the Northern Hemisphere, and so they look, well, certainly, and one of the wild cards right now is the generation to whom Navalny is appealing, the millennials and Gen Zs and that who are much more connected to the rest of the world and are much more sensitive about these things.
And more outspoken?
Within limits, yeah. But certainly more outspoken than their grandparents would have been. And it's funny, too, there's still this limited, maybe shrinking sphere in which a certain type of protest is publicly acceptable. And I think that's part of another problem. Unsurprisingly, there seems to be a split between urban and rural populations and urban and provincial populations in Russia, just like hearsay.
As has always been.
Yeah, and but the people that want Russia great again, their representatives are the people who govern with their support, also recognize that you can't have that great Russia without the expertise and the knowledge and the creativity demonstrated by these classes. So, and this is a story that goes back to Peter the Great, if not before.
There's this kind of inferiority complex that runs through Russian history compared to Western Europe.
There's an element of cringe, the Australian word that we post-imperial Anglophone settler colonists look at Mother Britain, but there is some. But of course, it also inspires this also sort of jingoism on the other side, and what we think of as Russian nationalism with anti-Semitism, xenophobia, given to conspiracy theories. And there's a lot of that in Russia,
easily disseminated on the internet.
Yeah. And internet that is still way more wide open than the Chinese version, which is also interesting to see. But there has been, certainly more recently there has been too. But this cringe to the West, whatever the West is, I hasten to add. It depends. In certain circles, Russian society isn't like that. In more educated and more professional circles, there's a sense that there's a real pride in what they've been able to do. For instance, the Sputnik V vaccine. It's probably a very interesting illustration of one of the problems, is that the population does not trust it. They're trying all sorts of measures to persuade people to get this vaccine. And, of course, this being Russia, the manufacturers, the people who devised it, the Gamaleya Institute, claim efficacy for it that some scientists seem to accept, like some scientists in Britain and the United States, but they won't publish the full data set, and for who knows what reasons, right? But it still is a remarkable achievement, especially using conventional virological techniques. And the Russian population won't trust it. Again, I'm afraid a very familiar sounding story.
They wouldn't have much better luck in Missouri.
took the words out of my mouth.
Well, let's look at the prospects of Russia's relationship with the United States militarily and economically when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with David MacDonald, and we're looking at Russia, and particularly now at its prospects today, economically, militarily, maybe even culturally, and certainly politically, with the United States. We mentioned at the beginning, David, that Russia is pretty much down to an oil economy.
Mm-hmm. Oil and certain minerals, and then in the East, softwood and some agricultural exports to China.
In a world that has a lot of oil and is cutting back on oil,
yep,
in particular,
yep,
how do you remain or become a world player when you have this very fragile one-horse economy?
Well, the IMF says you've got to diversify.
Right.
But the big thing is, and some people disagree with me, but I've always been struck by the fact that, again, going back to pre-Soviet Russia, there's always been more of a disconnect between financial and economic considerations and considerations of international interests or power politics than you would find in a Great Britain or the United States or France. And so one, they've got two assets coming in, whatever happens to the economy. One is they have they picked their predecessors well, that they've got this huge stockpile of nuclear inventory. They're still number two in the world, and they've still got a lot of intellectual expertise in delivery and in design and the rest of it. I'm not sure we'll see that super-duper missile that Putin was talking about.
Ultra-fast.
Yeah. But you know, the fact that he could make it sound plausible says something about the reputation among experts that Russia's earned for its abilities with certain type of military technology.
To do what with?
Well, look at how this country reacted to the prospect of North Korea maybe lobbing a missile in the direction of Hawaii. Now, we know Russian missiles are probably more accurate and probably have a greater range than the North Korean missile. There's probably more than 20 of them. And we know that North Korea got a lot of leverage out of out of version of blackmail. So you've got this threat, and you've got some certain tripwires. I think they've shown very clearly that Ukraine, that it's one thing to watch the Baltic republics and the old Warsaw Pact states move to NATO and the EU. It solves you a lot of administrative burdens and security burdens. It shortens your strategic so perimeter.
One way to look at it.
Oh. Well, these states were a pain to run and or to keep an eye on. And but Ukraine's different.
Well, it's their Black Sea ports in Crimea.
Certainly that. But it's a population that large parts of eastern Ukraine saw themselves as Russian until things started falling apart. But the ethnic boundaries aren't very clear, and Ukraine is very important in a certain type of historical sense of who Russia is. And it's one thing to have Hungarians go to NATO, but to have Ukrainians go to NATO, that's seen as too concessive. So that's one thing, but so they've got certain tripwires, and we're seeing them. And they're also reasserting themselves as interested players in the Middle East with the way they've held up the regime in Syria, the resistance they mounted over the incursions into Libya by the NATO powers, and their intervention in the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. So the government has its interests. But the other thing that makes them really interesting is, out of necessity, they figured out how to transition to cyber warfare.
And very successfully.
Yeah. And they had a huge they had a hugely developed capacity in cybernetics and computer programming. And it was never... The technology they were using wasn't nearly as advanced. They were about 10 years behind on the Moore's Law curve. And of course, that's an ever-expanding trajectory. But the ingenuity that Soviet and post-Soviet programmers had in dealing with and improvising with pretty old technology is just awe-striking. If you remember the game Tetris.
Yes.
Yeah, that was developed by Soviet software designers and working on a platform that was much less sophisticated than the ones that they were being developed in Japan and the United States at the time.
Well, it's a very inexpensive form of competition / combat.
You can do all sorts of things. You can knock out petroleum supplies to the Eastern Seaboard but they've just got the ability, and they've got a long tradition of – they've been doing this with their neighboring states for more than 10 years. Estonia has been a frequent target for this type of thing. And they've also – we saw how they could flood our information market with misinformation
for
during
the
last two elections.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why is that to their advantage?
Because – they can inflict certain types of damage on our support systems that are the support systems on which we rely, not just for gasoline supplies and that, but there's evidence they've gone pretty deep into what's supposed to be highly secure computers in the government. So you don't know what they can do, and that's one strategic asset, is to be unpredictable.
However, tit for tat.
Yeah. Unless they've got their own defenses.
I can imagine they would be just as vulnerable or more so than the Western powers.
In a perverse way, one would hope so, yeah. But in the meantime, their ability to use this technology, or the threat of its use, is overturned a long-held view of making war, which is what the Daniel Defoe called it, having a long purse. Whoever's got the longest purse is likely to win the conflict. And they have suddenly cast parts of that into doubt.
Now, with this cyber warfare, though, if we are ready to call it that.
Oh, cyber harassment or cyber skirmishing.
How much control do you think Putin has? Because according to him, I think, and other sources, these are not Russian government agents. They are independents who are not breaking any Russian laws, so why should we corral them? But do you think Putin actually has the power to corral these supposedly, wildcat pirates?
Well, before I came in here today, I was reading a Russian news aggregator, which also has an English language page called, it's called polit.ru. Which is a pun on half-liter vodka bottle. But they just announced today that the website for that for the ransomware operator that brought down what JBS Meat, Australia, Canada, the United States, and these other things, what they get $50 million, their website shut down and disappeared.
How fascinating.
Yeah. And there was they couldn't get it. Now they might have burrowed deeper in the dark web or that, but this was a Russian paper reported that and said the state power didn't make any connection. But, we know that this had come up in the last discussions between Biden and Putin. We know that President Biden had sort of made his displeasure known to Moscow last week. So there was an old principle that some older American president referred to as plausible deniability, and I think that's probably the nature of the relationship between a lot of these hacker groups and the Russian government. We know that even the people in 2016. Basically kids in a basement in St. Petersburg operating computers. And the misinformation, and it went all ways, right? It wasn't just pro Trump. It was designed to sow the type of discord that it did, although I don't know how effective it was in doing so. I think it was already there. But nonetheless, people have the impression that they did. They were ostensibly in a semi-private organization, but there's pretty strong consensus that they were an offshoot of military intelligence or counterintelligence.
Relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin?
I think at the end, Putin was basically gritting his teeth. I thought he was expecting one thing, and I just don't think he has had much respect for him. And I don't know about any of the dossier or any of that. I don't think he took him seriously. So it's interesting. One word that I think his press spokesman was saying last week was, or there was a report that Putin, in an interview, said, "Whatever you think of Biden, he's experienced and he's a serious man." And when you say serious in Russia, it means that you've got to take this. You've got to respect this person, you like him or not.
And he was a. Biden is a professional.
Yeah.
And therefore, back to this word, predictable, more predictable.
Yeah. But understands conventions, understands, like, international relations it rests on this whole semantics of, free and frank exchange means you almost came to blows. but there's, you need those... you have to have those matrices or those sets of symbols and rhetorics as ways of coding and finding ways to maintain a conversation, even in hostilities. And President Trump didn't seem to have any time for that. It might sound critical. I'm just describing what was the case, right? And I think he was unpredictable, and I think it was very hard. And he was, you know, ask Rex Tillerson, ask John Bolton, ask any of the people that served him, ask Mike Pompeo if he doesn't run for office. I think you'd find that they were all quite distressed at points by his volatility.
Final question.
Sure.
Was Putin interested in indicating that American democracy is really no better a foundation than whatever government the Russians have?
Oh, yeah. No question. I think that if we're going to talk about 2016, I think that's what it's all about, is just saying, and we've taken, we being NATO West, North America, what we have always taken a very minatory stance to the Soviet Union. Why don't you behave yourself? Why don't you clean up your act? Why don't you get democracy in that? And we tend to condescend to them. We don't even hear ourselves doing it. Sort of talk about them as the problem child. And Putin is saying, well, and again, to a population whose dystopic nightmare is the 1990s, he's basically saying, oh, you want democracy? Well, remember the 1990s, and that's a very strong rhetorical strain in his public discussions.
Chaos.
But look at the United States. Here's this mighty democracy. Look at whom they elect. Look at how they elect. Look at all the money that flows. You know, all things that a lot of critics on both sides of the aisle would agree about with the American system. But he's saying it to an audience that he's trying to dissuade. This is just an unruly, disorderly, undignified spectacle. And stirring that up didn't hurt. I think any influence they actually exercised in the election would have come to them as gravy. They would not have been expecting that or looking for that at all.
David MacDonald, always a pleasure.
For me too, Norman. Thank you.
Look forward to the next time.
Me too.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me the next time around for University of the Air.